Our first reader tonight is Catherine Rankovic. I've known Catherine Rankovic for about 10 years as a writer and fellow editor. I even know Catherine from before she was known primarily as an essayist, when she wrote and performed her poetry around town, and especially in Soulard. Catherine has an unflinching eye for the truth, and it may surprise no one to know that hers was originally a journalist's eye. But she also has an eye for the outrageous truth, her truth, the truth no one but Catherine Rankovic could write. My favorite lines from Catherine Rankovic's poems and essays are the funny ones, though Catherine is often funniest without at first trying to be funny. When she tells it like it is, or as she sees it, and it is so brutally and outrageously honest we can't help but laugh. She is also a poet, however, and both her humor and lyricism temper her revelations and help show us the compassion she brings to all her subjects. Earlier I mentioned I know Catherine as an editor. We used to plow through slush piles together several offices ago at River Styx. She has a keen editorial eye and ear. Having been on the receiving end of it with my own work, I know that she also has a sharp editorial scalpel, but one she never fails to take to her own work. I defy anyone to find one half-assed sentence in Catherine's writing. Even when she writes about the minutiae of her own life, her own successes or failures, we understand that Catherine is in the service of writing about something greater than herself, if nothing else, the honorable craft of writing a good, true, and balanced sentence. Catherine Rankovic has published essays in the Missouri Review, the Iowa Review, the Progressive, Natural Bridge, Del Mar, and St. Louis Magazine, and was one of the authors of the essay collection Guilty Pleasures, Indulgences, Addictions, and Obsessions, co-written with the 7 members of her writing group, The Doves, who have been together since 2000. That book is for sale right over there at the River Styx table. The Doves are preparing for publication 2 more essay collections. Catherine has a BA in journalism from Marquette University and worked as a magazine and newspaper journalist in Cincinnati and Boston. She has an MA from Syracuse University and an MFA from Washington University. She has taught creative writing at Washington University Day and Evening School since 1989, at the Washington University Summer Writers Institute, at the St. Louis Writers Workshop, and in the University of Missouri St. Louis Graduate MFA Program. She lives in Pacific, Missouri. Please welcome Catherine Rankovic.
Happy to be here tonight. It's a surprise for me and for everybody else. I decided to read this particular essay, which has not yet been published, because I know that the group here is mostly writers and that you wouldn't mind hearing an essay about a writer becoming a writer, in this case, in particular, becoming a poet. And maybe this is partly your story too, and that's what I'm hoping. You'll notice that in this essay, I'm sort of hard on my mother. However, but at the time that I'm writing about, which is the 60s and 70s, I didn't quite have the maturity or insight to see what her side of the story might be. So I'm aware, okay, of what it might sound like. And my mother is a very nice lady. This is called A Native of an Unpoetic Place. I burned everything I wrote from the time I was 8 until I was 14. I had scribbled in spiral-bound notebooks since I had first been able to buy them for 15 cents. And originally, I thought that owning them meant privacy for what I wrote in them. "Private my dupa," my mother said. The youngest of 7, she had spoken Polish at home long ago, on a farm in northern Wisconsin, without electricity until 1937, when she was 3. Kids should have privacy? She couldn't look at whatever she pleased in her own house? Who told me that? Is that what they taught me in school, while she and my dad were killing themselves working? "That's not what they teach us in school," I said, eyes on the carpeting. "Then who's teaching you to sass your mother?" "Nobody." I want to talk to your teacher right now. Go look up her number and call. Tell her I want to talk to her. After a second or two, I lifted my eyes very carefully to see if she meant it. Don't push me, baby, she shouted. I ran from the room. My mother called after me. And what are you writing that you have to hide it? Somehow the desire to write things got stuck in me, and mostly it only made trouble. It thirsted for solitude, the world's rarest and costliest luxury. With six people bucking for elbow room in a three-bedroom house the size of a two-bedroom apartment, I hid in the basement, or crouched in the coat closet with a flashlight, or stood buttoned into snow clothes at the workbench in our garage until the cloying smell of sawdust drove me out. There was nowhere else to go. The school locked its glass doors at 3:30. The public library was 3 miles away downtown, impossibly far, another planet. Simply leaving our yard required permission and an itinerary. City bus service ceased at 6 p.m., and my parents hated moving their cars after they had come home from their jobs and parked them. In any case, we were not allowed out alone after dark. And darkness and freezing weather kept us all in the house after 5:15 p.m. from September through March. We live 30 miles south of Milwaukee in Racine, Wisconsin, a semi-Soviet factory town set down between Chicago and Milwaukee on Lake Michigan, where it smells most of tar and fish kills. Racine is the world headquarters of Johnson's Wax, the city's largest and most desirable employer. Frank Lloyd Wright, given the commission in 1938, designed the 14-story Johnson's Wax office tower entirely without windows because Racine was not worth looking at. 30 years later, the tower was still empty, and to this day, it has never been used. My parents both work for the second largest business, J.I. Case, my father at the assembly line on the tractor plant, and my mother as a typist in their business office, where years of faultless service could not win her a promotion to the level of secretary. The skill she lacked was stenography. It took her 2 years of nights at the kitchen table, taking dictation from phonograph records to acquire it, just as it became obsolete. Daddy came home each weekday at 4 p.m., removed his steel-toed boots, took a chair, and looked at the newspaper until supper. He was European-born, a Serb, and the only male in our house. And at times he must have felt as if he'd been shanghaied at Ellis Island and bundled off to a jungle of nylons and hairspray. On Sundays, we visited his friends, other Serbian immigrants, some with tuba-shaped German war brides, and others with broad-beamed Serbian wives with gold teeth. And with them, my father had long and animated talks, but my understanding of their language was fragmentary, so that sitting through a three-hour visit was like sitting through a moonless night. At 5:15 p.m. on weekdays, Mom, a thick-waisted woman with a poodle permanent, filled the doorway like a tank. Highly maneuverable in small spaces, firing all the while, she finessed the narrows between the dinette and stove, or dressers and beds, scanning for items inevitably finger-marked or out of place. The house was crammed with leather-topped tables, and upholstered furniture she had wanted all her life and worked to pay for. She liked solid wood and fragile, worrisome lamps. Brought up Catholic, she also liked holy pictures. Mom's standard for the household she ran was perfection in every material and behavioral detail, and she decided what perfection was. Having four kids guaranteed that she would constantly come unhinged. And I, the eldest, thought it necessary to keep what I wrote to myself beneath her radar. It also pleased me to keep something secret and exclusively my own. I could trust nobody not to laugh at what I wrote. New lyrics for familiar tunes. Decoy poems written in the voice of a younger, sweeter child. The sort mentored by angels in sacred lithographs. and epic fantasies, sometimes spanning months and several notebooks, about girls with superhuman strength and magical powers. My intergalactic legion of supergirls eventually amassed a roster of more than 220 individual characters, many of them dreamed up during otherwise tedious wintry hours in church school on Saturday, or church service on Sunday, our parents' favorite places to leave us when they wanted to play cards or take a nap. During weekdays and summers, we were kept at heel by an American babysitter, a cross-eyed hag my mother treasured because she would do laundry and iron clothes. It was she, Mrs. Foot. Rest her soul. Who caught me writing by flashlight in the coat closet. I wouldn't have dared to do it when my parents were home. I was a nearsighted nail biter with a home haircut, but was also bright, stubborn, and venomous. And in fact, I was being superbly prepared for my life. Perpetually on trial at home, I developed a lawyer's wiles and an innocence complex. I finked on my sisters and was a wet blanket to the neighbor girls I played with. Seeing how elaborately I guarded my notebooks, because they were safest when I carried them, they or my sisters might snatch one and run and hold it up out of my reach while I circled them, jumping like a dog and pleading. My sixth grade teacher confiscated one such notebook and read it, and the next day told the whole class that I would grow up to write books for children. I was 12 and turned so red that my glasses steamed over. Honestly, they did. And then I seethed for a week because I thought she underestimated me. Burning solved everything. When no grown-ups were around, I opened the incinerator, a thickly enameled cast iron bin down in the darkest room of our basement, by stepping with all my might on the pedal that raised the lid. It opened with a crusty whine. I threw in the most recent notebooks, all open to the middle so they would burn faster. After tossing in the match and shutting the lid, I waited until the incinerator rumbled with a sound like that of a distant drummer. The heat would follow. I stood by, wishing childhood were shorter. Later, I learned to type clean copies of my poems in the school typing lab and arrange them in a binder I hid in back of a stack of ledgers in the same furnace room. I no longer wrote fiction, devoting that energy instead to inventing lies for my parents about where I'd been and what I'd been up to. My girlfriends and I rode the bus downtown and pretended to shop, or trespassed on the lakefront, its chilled sand and icy breakers cordoned off in fall and winter with orange sawhorses and warning signs. Once, after school, I walked all the way downtown with a boy I liked, an artist and poet with eyes like ash pits and no winter coat. I'd always had a secret life. Now I had a separate one. Crucially, a friend had lent me the novel The Bell Jar, which led me to Sylvia Plath's aerial poems. I understood very little, only that they were graphic and vengeful, and found this entirely to my taste. I apprenticed myself to her. She wrote a poem called Cut. I wrote one called Paper Cut. In January of my senior year, the chairman of the English department summoned my current English teacher and me to his desk. Mr. Barudian was 5 feet tall, hot-tempered, and bearded, said, "What the hell this and what the hell that?" And rumor had it that he understood James Joyce. That day, I expected some sort of crackdown, but was surprised. The two teachers focused entirely and benignly on me. They asked questions. Their eyes were alight. They had an entry form for a poetry contest for high school girls, and they thought I should enter it. "Look what she reads," my teacher said. She meant Ariel and Dylan Thomas's collected poems. Unable to understand more than two consecutive words of either book, I nonetheless carried the books around, hoping that they gave me a certain aura. "That's very difficult stuff," said the chairman. Modestly, I gazed at my lap. Then they wanted to know my plans. I got wary. Teachers talked. Possessing a spectacular gift for taking dictation and another for high-speed typing, I was the business department's pet. Until my second-year stenography teacher overheard me telling my classmates that secretarial work was uncreative and beneath me. She decided then to award to her second-rank student the annual business college scholarship sponsored by Johnson's Wax. On parents' night in November, my teacher told this to Mom, who came home firing her 105-millimeter howitzer and then couldn't look at me for a week without crying. I felt bad, but by then I had worked summer and holidays in offices 8 to 5, sitting exposed like a woodchuck at a desk out on the floor, people approaching me with boxes of slips and scripts and bills of lading and saying cheerfully, "I have a project for you," while I sat there, homicidal in the mornings or suicidal if it was after lunch. I said I hated it. This hurt Mom terribly. I said, "I'm not going to lie. You were the one who taught me never to lie." She said I'd blown my chance for a college education. I argued that the word college in business college did not really mean college. She knew that. She had had a semester of college herself. But semantics was her favorite rhetorical trap, as it is mine. It never occurred to me that Mom might cry because she felt scared for me. "You have to ask my mother," I told Mr. Barudian and Miss Replogle. "You're not going to college when you graduate from here?" "You have to ask my parents," I said. Dad was disabled now, and Mom said I would probably have to go full-time at Woolworth since factory work was for men. "Don't you want to go to college?" said Mr. Barudian. I said, "What's with the mumbledy peg? Speak up." "Yeah, yes. Now say what it is that you want. To go to college. How about a complete English sentence? I want to go to college. Raise a flag, like pulling teeth. God save us all, and this is one of the smart ones. Very good. What college?" I didn't know any colleges where I could learn to write poetry. He sent me to the school counselor who cut a deal with my parents. I would study journalism, not English, so I could be sure and get a job later. And it couldn't be at UW-Madison where the radicals might get me. And it couldn't be Northwestern because it had to be in Wisconsin. Marquette University is in the heart of Milwaukee. I got in on a partial scholarship. The Marquette University Memorial Library was a bold, award-winning, and stupefying piece of architecture. Corridors dead-ended at blank white walls. The library had 5 floors and a mezzanine, a vault-like room with narrow paths between the stacks. Fluorescent lights gave the room a star-lit quality. The mezzanine housed the volumes least in demand. I remember being impressed by a portly book titled Chinese Jews. On the mezzanine, shelved against the easternmost wall, I found the university's selection of literary journals. Thin, nearly faceless, with gray or robin's egg blue or midnight blue paper covers, they had poetry inside. Real poetry, what real poets, living poets, were writing. There was a journal called Poetry, one called Poet Lore, one called the Sewanee Review. Others were named for states. The Georgia Review, the Ohio Review. But there was no Wisconsin Review, great poetry, like great music, I guess, could never come from Wisconsin, unless it might come from me. It was the year of the national energy crisis, and every 20 minutes the lights clicked off and had to be reset. In the Marquette University Library, I picked up whatever I carried then, textbooks, notebooks, a shoulder strap purse. Found the light switch and went back to examine the literary journals, absorbing the feel of everything. Pages, the color and texture of eggshell. The waspish little book reviews in the back in small type, and the contributor's notes. Those I could read, but most of the poems were in a code I couldn't crack. Some I simply could not follow. Italicized lines in Latin or French were like roadblocks. Airy references to the Bowery, Amherst, the Tuileries, or Fire Island implied that everyone knew what and where those places were. From those journals, I gathered that I was a native of an unpoetic place, and that when I got out of college, I had to move to New York or New England, because that was where the poets were. I had discovered not only where the poets were, but what they did. They published their poems in journals like those on the shelves. Then they put them together in collections, published as the slender books I had begun buying, Sylvia Plath, Anne Sexton, Robert Penn Warren, Richard Brautigan. I fell in love with the journals. They made my heart beat harder. I longed to see my name in them, and now I knew how to start shaping my life. After 6 weeks, I was a regular on the student newspaper staff and learning how to write leads and cut lines, and already had a crush on its star columnist. A short, brash, balding senior, age 21, whose glittering, practically arterial writing talent was the only reason anyone tolerated his presence. He seemed to think that vaulting the desks, singing Irish ballads, pinching people's necks, and setting fires in ashtrays might obscure the gift that set him apart from us earnest College of Journalism types, who wanted only to rake up the next set of Pentagon papers. He thought he was very funny. He told the newsroom, "Why did President Ford stop playing water polo?" "Because his horses kept drowning." This young man, I was fascinated because I had never before seen a born writer, was besotted with the works of Hunter Thompson, then unknown to me, and worshiped sports. But unlike most Americans obsessed with sports, he happened to play one. By sheer coincidence, he was also on the university fencing team, which I had joined because I had tried fencing for a week in high school, and it was the only sport I had ever liked. I was thrilled to travel on Saturday mornings in a pack that included him, to compete with other college fencing clubs, most of them comparably unprepared and complaining loudly of hangovers. Serious fencers, rare and noble, made us jeer. Mom always suspected that writing was one of the ways I subverted and thwarted her. She had not found a way to stop me, but she was right. She received a corroboration of this when she discovered at home, soon after I had started college, the cache of poems that I had thought well hidden. She read them all. There was one about sexual desire. There was one about being addicted to pills. Although I had never in my life seen, much less swallowed, even one such pill. The poem imitated the work of one of my favorite poets, Anne Sexton. When my mother confronted me, I realized with a sinking heart that this would be impossible to explain. If at all possible, I stayed away from home, but that weekend I was fighting my sisters for cold weather clothes they'd appropriated from my sliver of the closet. I was arguing over a sweater with one of them when Mom's voice, piercing the floorboards from below, ordered me down to see her in the furnace room immediately, if not sooner. I saw that she had opened the cabinet and had my binder, but she did not have my 5-year diary, a fat little black satin-covered book with a token lock and 4 lines for each day. I had bought and begun the diary at age 13. I had left it almost filled. "I can't believe you grew up in this house," Mom began. "This is not how I raised you. We always made sure you had everything. We wanted you to get educated, and you write this crap. Explain it to me. Explain what it means." I said nothing. Such requests were always rhetorical. Mom expressed shock and horror, but not disappointment. On the contrary, the poems confirmed what she thought I'd been doing all along. She was far too intelligent to believe what she was saying. I had just graduated from high school with honors, held school records for typing and shorthand speed, and had won the high school poetry prize, $10 and a certificate, given by the Lakeshore chapter of the National League of American Pen Women. But Mom never passed up a chance to create a scene. It may have been her art form. A pale, fleshy woman, less like a tank now and more like a leaky sailing ship, rigged all over with raw nerves. My mother filled her lungs and raged, turning crimson and monstrous and louder and hoarser until her voice became a bark, which she could sustain for as long as 4 hours. Over the years, she had convicted me of laziness, deceit, insubordination, ingratitude, atheism, denting my dad's car, guilty on all charges, communism, and prostitution, which is what I must have been doing on the days I did not come straight home from school. But I had been living away from her in a place without open hostility, using her money, providing an education that now allowed me to wonder for the first time if it wasn't she who was the distorted one. For years she'd seen me lolling and reading my books, all true life stories, over and over. Kieran, about a disabled girl, written by her mother. Mrs. Mike, the story of a city girl married to a Canadian Mountie. And a World War II memoir called I Am 15 and I Don't Want to Die. God knows what my mother had read to make her believe that the pursuit of art was dangerous while the business world was safe. In college, as in high school, it was agreed that all mothers scream and cry, usually for nothing. But that day, my mother had my poems in her hand. Not daring to leave the room or interrupt, I stood there and took grim pleasure in recalling the lies she had not caught me in, and the fact that carbon copies of my poems were in my locker at school. Poetry, I thought, shutting her out. Poetry, poetry, poetry. She decided on the spot to pull me out of school and send me to do office work to help support the family. We'd drive to Milwaukee tomorrow and pick up my things, and I would see what it was like to work, really work, not like those little summer jobs I always whined about. "I'm so depressed," you said. "Depressed," my mother yelled. "What is this depressed? You're born, you work, you die." This broke me and I started crying. Mom held out the poems in her shaking hands. "Take them, tear them up." I cried as I tore, because if she meant what she said, my life would be wasted. And a couple of years down the road, if I were still alive, I wouldn't even have a choice about killing myself. Once the poems were in pieces, she said, "You're lucky that I don't throw you out of the house," and left me. I was not removed from school. Within hours, my mother had relented. She even asked why I did not write poems about my family. I wasn't grateful for the reprieve. I felt that whatever made me want to write had another life, which need not respect the boundaries set for me. Its force only grew and took strength from opposition. It would always excuse whatever I did or wanted or didn't want. It would also sustain me, proving stronger than fear or reason or disease. It would prove itself stronger than love, and it would stand in for the will to live during the times when that would be lacking. When my mother was not angry, she sometimes said to me, "That pointed chin, it means that you're determined." That Christmas, Mom gave me a book, The Poet's Manual and Rhyming Dictionary. Eventually, I moved east and cruised for poetry journals and books in Ohio, Massachusetts, and New York. In marble Carnegie libraries with cast iron trim, in busy university libraries, in public libraries and their shabby, deserted branches. I trolled bookstores, wide, narrow, tall, and dusty, Harvard Square bookstores, feminist bookstores, radical bookstores with rough pinewood shelves holding red and white pamphlets dog-eared like sores. And timid gift shops in remote mountain towns where the only book of poetry for sale might be the poems of Abraham Lincoln. I saw the average bookstore shrink to nearly nothing, and then in the 1980s suddenly swell to the size of a city block, so large that it may have fish ponds and serve meals. In bookstores, no matter what kind they are, I feel welcome, safe, and understood. In the poetry section, I am usually left alone. Watching the tidal movements, the risings and flux of poets' fortunes, I learned about the business of poetry, how sudden eminence inexplicably fades, that some superb writers never even break the surface, that some poets are lucky and some are connected, that some poets return after death. And whose are the durable names stamped on book after book after book? In poetry, nothing is quick, but everything is terribly perishable. Poets are the orchids of the literary world. This may be why they so often write about fragile things like the chambered nautilus and qualities of light. Eventually, I met some of the poets whose works I've seen on the shelves. Some have been my teachers. I envy a few. Some I've seen and heard at readings. Once, seated in a ballroom in Boston, I dared to reach between the Cromwell chairs and touch the back of a tweed jacket so lightly that an unfortunate name. It seems important that a poet have a good, ringing name. What happened to Goldbarth? When did Levertov die? I met her when she was reading anti-nuclear bomb poetry in 1982. Merwin and Kuman, lone survivors of their circle, the real stars having burnt out. Sometimes when poets die, they seem to take their poems with them. And the presses that publish poetry, persistent, fading, ascendant, descendant, triumphant, Grove Press, City Lights, Four Way Books, Grey Wolf, Copper Canyon. I know which publishers have the most weight and prestige, Farrar, Straus, Giroux, Knopf, and Norton. I know, too, the names of the lightweights and the clever names of presses destined to short, precarious lives. Soft Skull Press, Shameless Hussy Press. Now and then, I still read recent books of poems. Some obviously excellent poetry leaves me feeling nothing. The last book that enthralled me was Ted Hughes' Birthday Letters. And that's because I'd always loved his wife, Sylvia Plath. Every word of hers that seen print I have read and reread, looking for who she was and who I am. Certain books I dismiss because of prejudice against their lack of capital letters or their ugly covers, or the too glamorous author photo, or prejudice against the author himself, as in the poems of Jim Morrison, the poems of Jimmy Stewart. It is possible that the poetry in these volumes is good. I've paged through a few, feeling as if I were upending a cereal box, seeking edible crumbs. I know whose poems are published out of duty or pity. In the 20th century, the poet came to matter as much as the poem, maybe more. I asked myself if I would write poetry if my name was not attached to it. I decided that I would. But I am now 46, and I don't write any more poetry. Maybe because my mother is not around to tell me not to. My poems would have meant nothing but another book on the shelves. By now, I care only a little. I saw my crush again when I lived in Boston in my mid-20s. Twice I ended up working briefly in newsrooms where he was also employed. His behavior was unchanged. But by then, braying like a jackass had become a viable form of self-promotion. Within a few years, he would be famous. I was scraping along in life, filing stock photographs or compiling local events listings. I asked him to put in a good word for me somewhere. By the end of my freshman year, it was said of me, "She writes," which gave me some satisfaction, no matter in what tone it was said. Trying to become a poet, this method was still current. I had drunk myself sick 3 times. Once in late fall, drinking a whole bottle of Burgundy because the writer I had a crush on could not be induced to have a crush on me. The room spun amazingly. I felt like a tick in a toilet. Of course, I wrote about it. Actually, the poem isn't that bad. I had taken my first plane ride in a 4-seater and my first motorcycle ride and had drunk my first beer. It tasted like soap. I'd avoided a D in advanced German, but the C- still lost me my partial scholarship. And I would have to go home for the summer disgraced and depressed because I knew what sort of welcome awaited me and how I would spend my time. In the library, the piles of journals had grown. Fall 74, winter 74, spring 75. That year I'd also taken courses in World History 1 and 2, journalism and formal logic. But I had more going for me. Early in the spring semester, I decided to send some of my new poems to the real literary journals. That spring in March, a junior English major suggested I discuss my poems with one Father Boyle, head of the university's English department, and the author of a noted study of James Joyce. Timidly, but I was bold enough to do it, I phoned Father Boyle's office. Not a Catholic, I was not used to telephoning priests. I said something like, somebody told me to tell you I wrote poetry and to talk to you about it. Is that okay? He sighed and gave me an appointment. I went to his office at the appointed time and waited half an hour. He didn't show. I was angry and ashamed and told no one. On a warm spring day on Wisconsin Avenue, my crush, who was graduating, tipped his Irish tweed cap to me, smiled, said, "Have a nice life," and ran off. I dreaded the summer. The university had notified my parents about the lost scholarship and the threat of academic probation. Mom had found a job for me in the office where she worked. I could ride there and back with her every single day. Without advice then, I typed up 4 or 5 envelopes of my new poems and sent them to the literary magazines. I told myself I had nothing more to lose, and it might be my last opportunity. Mom could open the return envelopes and read the poems if she liked. They were not about sex or about pills. They were about death and endings. I did not yet know much else about what poets did, except they lived poetic lives and died poetic deaths and made beauty out of fury and loneliness. And this made me think I had a chance.